So Shan, first of all, welcome to the BizSpark show.
Thank
It's
you.
an honor to have you here. It's been amazing just watching you in the ecosystem, helping entrepreneurs as well as just being a mentor, as well as running your own business. What I wanted to start off with was just kind of that initial moment, and if you can tell me about the time, back when you were working in the philanthropy space and kind of dabbling in that and kind of how that spark happened for you.
So my career up until about 2 years ago, I was a philanthropic advisor, which means that I worked with private foundations and high net worth families to help them figure out how they wanted to give back now that they had made all of their kind of wealth. And there were two things I realized from that really influenced me. One was that almost all of them had made their wealth through equity. It was almost never as an employee because salary is just never going to do it unless you're the CEO of Pepsi. It's just not going to. So equity, they would have some family business and then they sold it for $30, $40 million, a nice amount. And the other thing I realized was that for most of these people in their mind, they were creating a real firewall between making money, which was devoid of social justice principles or, kind of their philanthropic ideals and giving it away. And that these two had nothing to do with each other. And I said to myself, I would so much rather, because I would definitely like to earn millions of dollars, but I'd like to do it in a way that incorporates my social values and that makes the world better rather than kind of putting that to the side, doing anything to make a buck. And then giving away 5% to charity.
Got it.
So I kind of said, I want to start a socially responsible business as my path.
So you kind of experienced this, and then was there like a moment, a day, a conversation, a mentor, like what created that spark for you? Because I'm sure a lot of people are there that think about starting their own company. Either they are afraid, either they are, they don't have the right support system, or there's something stopping them back. And so, what was that defining moment for you?
I had always been what they like to call an intrapreneur, someone who had been starting things and coming up with ideas within the companies that I worked for. And then honestly, I was just in a professional situation that was unsustainable for me. The company I was working for, the people I was working for, and I said, I have to, for my mental health, I have to get out. But I actually think people waiting for that spark or that perfect moment, it's never gonna come. It's just, there's no perfect moment. It's always a bad time. It's always, oh, well, I'll wait till I get that bonus. Oh, I'll wait till I get that project done. Oh, I'll wait till my kids are older. There's always going to be a reason. And at a certain point, it's about you having the crazy combination of incredible confidence and yet humility to realize you don't have it all figured out, but confidence that you will figure it out, that you can figure it out, and you just make the decision to go for it. And I think that, it's rarely a moment in time so much as it is a, ongoing mindset.
So it's always there, just kind of
And
is
then, yeah, I
waiting
mean, I
to.
guess in a way you make a decision at some point. You make the decision and you say, I've had enough, or
I'm gonna
this
do
is it,
this.
I'm gonna do it. Like, hopefully, and for me, actually, I had wanted to leave my company for years, but I didn't know what I was gonna do. And so it was, I wanted to be going toward something rather than running away from something. And so I think it was when I had the idea for my business and I was like, aha, that's something I can go toward. That's something I can build and create and be proud of. That made me finally go, this is it. This is my personal exit strategy.
So on that thought, like, when you had that idea or when you, when you experienced that problem, and you know, tell us a little bit about obviously, you know, the problem itself, and kind of a little bit about MoxieGene, and you know, how you sort of came about this concept of this is it, like this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
So if you want to give me like a quick sort of you know, how you came up on the problem.
Yeah, birth story.
Yeah, the birth story. There you go.
Origin story. I think that's what they call it for superheroes. Yeah, my superhero origin story. So I am a mom of three young kids, and my kids were 7, 5, and 1. And I was a consultant. I was traveling. I was busy. And my niece was born. And I started to go through that process of digging through the closets and, like, what clothes do I have that I can share with her? And I didn't really have the time, and it was taking up space. And I thought I would pay somebody to just deal with this for us. You know, I don't like the cost and the waste of always buying new, but didn't have a very efficient way to pass on clothes. And so I thought, you know, there are millions and millions of working moms like me that I think would also be willing to pay kind of for this convenience. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's it. That's the idea. Like, I think that's powerful enough. I think it's universal enough that this is my you know, big idea, because I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur, but I didn't know what would be a good business. And then when I found this, I thought it was big enough to hold the ambition that I had for it.
So when you tell people about MoxieGene today, how do you talk about the company since that time, and, you know, how has it evolved? Has it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it evolves and it continues to evolve. I think, you know, even this week, I think differently than I did last week, you know, about the business. But we actually started out and our name was Good Karma. And the idea was the clothes were Good Karma. What comes around goes around, and we share what it is. And it was a subscription service where you could get, you know, outfits in the size you need now. And then when you're done with them, you send them back and you get the next size up. And it was very elegant, and it was sort of, we had thought of all the contingencies, but what we couldn't anticipate was kind of the emotional reality of what moms go through. And what we found was that moms did not want to subscribe because, in essence, they didn't want to borrow our clothes with the burden of knowing they had to give them back. They felt like they had to take care of them. And so even though we would say, oh, no, that's okay if you get them stained or if you mess them up, that's okay. We expect some of them to be ruined. They, in their mind, were, no, that's not for me. My kid's too messy. And so we said, well, what if instead of lending them to you, we just sold them to you and they're yours? And that way, if you ruin them, fine, so be it. If you don't ruin them, you can sell us whatever clothes that you have that are in good shape. So that's what we do now. And our tagline for the business is upscale resale for baby and kids clothes. And when we talk about upscale, we don't necessarily mean expensive brands, although we do have Burberry and Oilily and, you know, Jacadi and all those kind of premium brands. What we mean is the experience should be upscale. So what we kind of, my vision and intention for the company is that if we can make resale as attractive and as easy for moms as buying new, then more moms will do it. And that ultimately creating a viable secondhand market that is curated, that is trustworthy, that is simple, will help reduce consumption of new materials. When I see things like the factory collapse in Bangladesh, and I think that's the cost of $5 t-shirts at big box stores.
Yeah.
You know, it's getting cheaper and cheaper, and the labor is paid less. And, you know, it's not just that one tragedy. It's also the everyday tragedy of the conditions that most garment workers face. And so to me, it is by creating a secondhand market, you're hopefully going to increase the standards for the firsthand market, and, you know, reduce that kind of what they call fast fashion, mm-hmm. just bad for the planet, bad for us, bad for the workers, you know. So that's, you know, that's really the vision where we are now.
Nice. You know, when you talk about upscale, it kind of reminds me of one of the shows that I was seeing the other day. similar concept, but more around just, you know, high-end designer label bags and clothes and whatnot. So when you think about sort of, you know, some of the things that you're doing and some of the existing businesses that are in that similar realm, like, are there mentors in the industry around you that you're looking at who are sort of in that, you know, either the clothing industry or, you know, something to do with children, which you can then, you know, sort of look at someone else's business and take lessons and learn from them? Like, are you kind of connecting with folks around?
Yeah, so the industry, I would call as a whole, collaborative consumption, which is the name kind of given to this idea that you don't own it forever. You kind of get it, use it, put it back into the system. And you know, in fashion, most collaborative consumption businesses are around women's designer, as you said, high-end labels.
Yeah.
And the ones that I think do it really well, and there's actually a lot of them now popping up, but you know, one in particular I think does a great job is called Nasty Gal. Mm-hmm. And what I love about what she does is there's a sense that each piece has a story, and they organize it into collections or lookbooks, which is actually unknowingly, it's the same thing that we did. So, you know, for example, we organize our girls' clothes into one of four style lines so that if you like tea time, which is pastels and princess kind of stuff versus Riot Girl, you know, which is like punk rock, right? Black and purple kind of stuff. And I think that layer of curation, they really do well, and it helps to keep your inventory fresh and give it a story so that you don't feel like, you know, what you don't want to do for us is feel like it's the Goodwill but online.
Mm.
It should feel more like a boutique but online.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, they do that really well.
And so, you know, that kind of gets into the topic of branding and marketing. You know, you mentioned boutique. So how do you, when you think of Moxie Jean today as a brand, sort of, you know, what have you done leading up to the branding process and the marketing process that you think, you know, entrepreneurs who have just an idea and who are sort of looking at that, you know, big sort of end game vision and trying to think of creating a brand, like what are some of the things you think they can learn from you?
Well, you know, I think when we started, one of the things we were really conscious of, when I say we, it's myself and my sister, who's my co-founder, and we're both moms, and, you know, again, kind of high-paid corporate, you know, jobs.
Yeah.
And we both felt that we were our target market. And so we said, what is important to us in a company? And we realized that transparency in the operations and being trustworthy, but also being just real about the challenges of parenthood, you know, those things were important to convey in our voice. And the thing about reputation and brand is that it just like your personal reputation, it is the accumulation of 1,000 small acts. It's every post that you put on Facebook. It's every tweet that you send. It's every aspect of customer service. These things combine up into a brand. So I think people tend to like think the name mm-hmm. or the logo is the brand. But in fact, those things are kind of a blank slate. They're there for people to fill and project onto it whatever you give them, and you fill it with their experiences. And so, you know, that's why we like the name Moxie Jean, because on the one hand, Moxie is a great word, right? It's like attitude and mm-hmm. spunk, and she's got moxie, and that's mm-hmm. kind of what it takes to be a mom. And on the other hand, Moxie Jean is meaningless, mm-hmm. right? It was a vessel mm-hmm. to be filled by whatever we made it stand for.
Yeah. That's pretty insightful to think of a brand from more of a, you know, personal perspective, because you're right, like a lot of people, the first thing they do at startup weekend or even when they're starting off with their prototypes and mock-ups are, oh, we need a logo and we need a brand name, and you know, they kind of get hung up in that, and I think it's really important to kind of clarify that message a lot. Switching gears a little bit, you know, in terms of some of the challenges that you've had to face just as a mom, as an entrepreneur, as well as, you know, someone who's trying to do so much in the ecosystem already, in the startup ecosystem. I know you're in the Mayor's Diversity Council, so you have all these other sort of advisory roles, and you're also advising on the Impact Engine, you know, as an organization. So there's so much going on. And so, you know, when you kind of started out with Moxie Gene and started taking on bigger and more challenging roles, tell us about some of the challenges that you faced. You know, was there ever a time when you went, you know, gee, this is just too hard. Like, I, you know, I need like an admin or an assistant or something like that.
Yeah, well, like many entrepreneurs, I think I'm too much of a control freak to have an admin. I wouldn't let them do anything, you know. I'd be like, that's fine, I'll do it. My travel, I like particular things in my calendar and all
yeah.
that. You know, I would say early on, one of the things that was a incredibly pivotal moment for us looking back was participating in an accelerator here in Chicago called Accelerate Labs that is now Techstars Chicago. They were kind of acquired as the Chicago outpost of Techstars. And my sister and I and our mother, who's our third kind of partner, went to the open house that they had for people interested in learning about the program. And I remember the director, the CEO, got up and he was talking about how, you know, we're looking for the kind of people that if you see a problem, you know, you say, all right, guys, let's order a pizza. We're going to stay till midnight and we're going to knock this out. We're going to code it. And we looked at each other and we're like, that's not us. That's not us at all. So yeah. First, you know, I don't like pizza that much and it seems to be a staple. But more importantly, I have three young kids. I'm not staying until midnight. It's not that I'm not willing to work the hours. In fact, I'm probably up with the baby sooner than like yeah. 3 or 4 hours before many, many people. But that moment was where I could have said, I think we could have said, this isn't for us. This isn't meant for us as moms, as, you know, people who are older than the average. You know, I'm 37 now, and I'm the youngest of the three of us. And so, but we said, you know what? There had been a mom who did it the year before us. And I said, she did it with two young kids, and she must have made it work. So we're going to apply, and we're going to make it work. And, you know, the reality was we did make it work, and Accelerate was absolutely fantastic and welcoming and very accommodating, so that my schedule was like, start working at 6 in the morning, at 5 o'clock, take the train home, spend a couple hours with my kids. And when the kids go to bed, get back on the computer at my house, you know, and go back at it. So my hours were a little different, but it was still, we were working just as we were getting as much out of it. And then, of course, my wonderful husband and I would tell him like 3 nights a week or like 2 nights a week, you know, and then I'll really try to be home for dinner. But also kept it kind of time limited. It's like, yeah. Not going to be like this forever, but this summer, you know, it's going to be intense. Yeah. And then I think, you know, when it comes to business, actually running the business, the challenges of an entrepreneur are the challenges of an entrepreneur. They're all the same, but the difference is not in what you're facing, but in what people, some people, project onto you because you are a woman and a mother. So they will ask you about questions or issues that they just wouldn't think to ask a man. And things like, you know, is this a lifestyle business? Are you having any more children? What's going to happen, you know, if you want to expand beyond the mom business? So seeing it as you can only be successful here because you're a mom as opposed to because you're a business person. So the reality of what I'm dealing with day to day is just like any other entrepreneur. But unfortunately, when people, I think, look at you and say, oh, mom, female entrepreneur, then they have expectations. So it's more about managing their expectations than it is about anything in my reality. And so, but realizing how important that moment was, where I almost took myself out of the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if you've read Lean In,
mm-hmm.
But I found that book to be absolutely 100% spot on with my experience. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, there are these moments where you decide, am I going to lean in or am I going to let it go?
Yeah.
Am I going to push for that or am I just going to not say anything? And I think, you know, in the tech space, there are a lot of little signs that say, you're not our target market. You know, whenever there's something called a booth babe, like you can have your picture taken with this model. Like what? Why would I want my picture to, like, you're so clearly assuming that your audience here is like young men.
Mm-hmm.
Just all those small signals over time that add up, you know, and so I think being a counter signal, I'm just trying to be a counter signal to other women to say, you know what, there's lots of other moms and women and there's space for you and you are wanted and you are needed. And also, you know, the other thing I always tell investors and the mayor's council, I always say, you know, where there's opportunity, I said, I do not think there's a single need of 20-something white guys that has not been met. Nothing. There is something for, at this point, anything you're going to come up with is so niche,
yeah.
Or there's 10 other companies doing it. Do you know where there's huge, massive opportunity? Women, Latinas, people on the south side of Chicago, they all have phones, but they don't necessarily have PCs.
Yeah.
They, you know, they all have apps. They all have, you know, that's where opportunity is. And so the people who are thinking of those markets, the future massive game-changing companies and ideas are going to be women, people of color, you know, people from lower socioeconomic, you know, backgrounds, because that's the unaddressed markets or other countries, right? So, you know, what they call the bottom of the pyramid, that the needs of those people, there are not thousands of companies clamoring for a tiny slice. There's huge opportunity there, much more so, I think, than everybody fighting over that 1%.
No, that's totally true. You know, you talked about it a little bit earlier when you talked about applying to Accelerate Labs, which is Meltech Start Chicago, and, you know, some of your experiences there. And, you know, you talked about how you were, you know, not in that age group, if you may, because there's everyone here at 1871 is probably, what, in their early 20s,
yeah.
Right? And, you know, there's entrepreneurs that I see even at, you know, the New Venture Challenge, where there was a Global New Venture Challenge and there were some older entrepreneurs. And it's ironic that it's kind of getting flipped, because 10 years ago, you had to be someone experienced, you had to have credibility, you had to have a lot of, you know, just, I guess, experience behind you to even be considered to run your business. And today it's kind of flipping up literally on the opposite side of the spectrum, where you're a 20-something, and that's the, you know, the average entrepreneur out there. You know, when you looked at that and when you were thinking about just challenging the status quo and sort of, you know, in that room full of, I'm assuming, 20-something male entrepreneurs, what were some of the things that you said to yourself? Because I'm sure there's a lot of women entrepreneurs out there across the globe that are thinking about ideas or even working on them, you know, just from their homes or from their schools, and, you know, thinking about not being in that majority. And so what were, like, some of those, you know, what was the thought process? Like, what were some of those two or three things that you told yourself, which were, like, you know, really sort of the balancing pieces for this equation, I guess?
Well, I think one of the reasons that we fetishize young entrepreneurs was because 10 years ago, the people who were in their 30s and 40s did not have the tech savvy, maybe, you know, that they themselves, you had to be 20 to like really be a digital native. But now there are people who are 30, 40, you know, who are themselves digital natives, so they're more likely to, you know, have that, I think, focus, so that hopefully the pendulum, which swung way too far toward that, you know, 20-something whiz kid, is coming back a little bit to the, hopefully to the middle, which does value experience more, because, I mean, that's the thing. It's not just having an idea. It's not just being able to code. It is, you know, to be a successful entrepreneur, you have to know a little bit about so many topics, that having some experience coming in, you know, and being a grown-up, you know, is, I think, it got undervalued there for a while, and now it's, I think, coming back to into fashion. But the other thing is what I was saying about kind of markets and this idea that there have been so few women entrepreneurs at scale.
Yes.
There's always, women have always been entrepreneurial on very micro levels, you know, in their community, selling the things that they make. Etsy is an incredible example of, you know, this community of thousands and thousands of micro entrepreneurs, right? So, but to have that confidence to kind of take it to the next level is really also about that the rest of the skills. It's not just the idea, but it's the rest of the business skills, and then being able to sell yourself. And as women, we're often encouraged to be humble and to underplay and let other people toot our horn. And it's challenging for us to own our successes and to, you know, be proud and selling what we've done. And I think that a lot of times women, again, they need that push to kind of either A, believe that they can make something bigger, but then be willing to tell other people and, mm-hmm. and to brag about it, you know, if you will. We have all kinds of unflattering names mm-hmm. for women who share their successes, and, you know, it's complicated.
Yeah.
It is complicated to be a confident woman. Yeah. It's complicated. And and I think that, you know, for me, I had that self-confidence to be willing to put myself out there and be judged. And I think it's hard. It's safer to not take the risk and to not tell anybody, because then they can't poke holes in it. And that's where the humility comes in. So it's, as I said, this combination of incredible confidence to be willing to put yourself out there, but also humility to take the reaction and try to make yourself better and make your idea work better.
Sweet. Yeah, that's really, really insightful. I think for especially the younger entrepreneurs who are sort of looking at it from the outside going, gee, should I jump in or not? And for the people in the corporate space who are, you know, in their day-to-day jobs, but that are thinking about things on the side and then, you know, in that dilemma. This is, I think, super, super helpful for both mindsets in my perspective. And then, you know, in terms of sort of the future vision, I mean, you've had what, 2 years now?
Well, really one.
1 year? One. Wow, that's...
One is good karma, and just 1 year is Moxie Jean. So,
and you've seen all the success coming out of just 1 year. When you think about the next 5 years, like, what's that vision looking like?
Yeah. Well, first, you know, a word about success, because I always say you cannot compare your private reality with somebody else's press release, right? So their press release is like... the shiny, it's like comparing yourself, as a woman, it's like comparing yourself to the actresses on the red carpet, mm-hmm. you know, who've wearing their Spanx and their, you know, hair's been done and they have a professional stylist and the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then you look at your, like, you know, got out of the shower and no, realize what's happened. That's what a press release is. It's that actress on the red carpet. And too often, I think as an entrepreneur, you want to project success, so does everybody else. And so you compare yourself to what looks like from the outside. And now I forgot the question.
I was talking about the vision of Moxie.
Oh, yeah.
5 years out.
Yeah.
And, you know, even to quantify, like, you have, you know, lots of users, you're you know, making revenue. So those are great measures of success as well.
Yeah, and so we really have viewed loyalty and customer satisfaction and sort of those as our most important measures of success, of getting the product right. And then in the next, you know, year, we really have to drive trial. We have to drive people who've never bought resale before to try it out. Because what we find is that if they try it, they're thrilled, they come back. They spend more money with us. They're loyal. They tell their friends, all that kind of stuff. But it's like getting over that initial hump. So what we're hoping in the next couple of years is that we kind of start to change the norm of what people expect with clothes, and particularly with kids' clothes, where you get so little use out of them. You know, that before the kid outgrows them. And again, in the U.S., we tend to think of them as very disposable. We just, you know, you kind of just throw it out, or you give it to Goodwill, which basically throws it out. I mean, they sell a tiny percentage, and most of it goes to recycling. Mm-hmm. And people kind of have this vision that they think
that
is being reused, and it's really not.
So just continuing on, like, so when you think of, you know, the challenges from here to there, you know, the 5 years out and being sort of the central hub for upscale resale, what are some of the, I guess, lessons that you think other entrepreneurs could learn from when you think about, hey, you know, here are the 5 things I need to keep in mind as I kind of make traction and try to be reach that goal, if you may. Because, you know, as entrepreneurs, there's the glass is always half full.
Yeah.
Right. But there's reality and there's challenges. And so how do you kind of balance that?
Yeah.
And what do you have for others?
I think the most important lesson and the thing I keep coming back to is, as an entrepreneur, there is a big difference between people telling you, I love your idea, or I love your product, or I love your business, and people saying, I love your product, and here's my credit card. And that we tend to measure success, or we think we've done market research, if our friends tell us we love it, or if the press writes about us. I had won pitch competitions. I got into this big accelerator, all with an idea that was fundamentally flawed. And basically what was happening was people were saying, I love it, I love it, but nobody was buying it. And you know what matters in the end? People buying it. And, you know, it wasn't until we kind of swept away all the good, nice, feel-good, happy stuff and focused on the real lack, you know, revenue, lack thereof, that we changed our business model from the Good Karma to MoxiGene. And, you know, even today, like, I'll continue to look at this. Like, yeah, it's great to get, you know, people saying nice things, but the question is, are people buying your product? And if they're not, you know, you have to look at why and not be satisfied with where you are. I think that, you know, we've made a couple of small tweaks, you know, even since launching MoxiGene. It's not that we launched it and it was perfect and we've stayed that. We've made some changes since then. And I think you have to keep looking for how could it be a little better? How could we get even mass, you know, greater masses of people to try it out? And, you know, that, again, that difference between, you know, PR buzz and actual customers is really critical. So that's definitely one. And I think, you know, another one is, again, recognizing that there's no such thing as overnight success. That, you know, I think I read recently someone, again, with the press release, someone said, when you see when someone sells the company or like they have this big media moment, you're seeing their moment of glory. And what you don't see is the hours and the years and the stress and the, you know, long nights that went into up to that moment. And so, you know, just keeping in mind that their private reality is just as hard as your private reality, and not kind of putting yourself down or, you know, losing faith.
Yeah.
Because you know your own private reality.
Yeah.
But you only know their press release.
Exactly. That's really awesome. I think the one parting thought that I wanted to ask you and hopefully leave the audience with is, how has this changed your life, you know, as a person? Do you find it, you know, a balancing feeling? You know, where have you come from as a person, and how have you evolved? And, you know, for people who think that entrepreneurship is all sweat and blood. And
well, I mean, I would say this. Being an entrepreneur has drained my bank account, but it has filled my soul.
Nice.
You know, that, I mean, my quality of life, getting up to build and work on something that I believe in so deeply every day, and knowing that I'm controlling my own destiny and my own company and, you know, really working to make it happen, the quality of life is worth so much more than the zeros in a paycheck. And I wouldn't go back, and everything made me who I am and, you know, the whole thing, but you know, it is blood, sweat, and tears, but it's the most satisfying and rewarding, you know, to be doing hard work and seeing results. So I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Well, on that thought, we wish you all the best
Thank
for
you.
Moxygene, and you know, we hope to hear great stories in the future, and
hope
to connect soon as well. But thank you again for
sharing. Yeah, thanks for having me.
All your thoughts and lessons, and I'm sure you know people out there are not only inspired and motivated, but they're probably getting out of their seat and ready to go and do their own business or take their next idea to the next level. So thank you.
Good.
This was really, really inspiring.
Good.
Thanks a lot.